Hello and welcome to this month's CIO live stream. My name is Kiran Ganesh. I'm Global Head of Investment Communications here in the Chief Investment Office, and I'm joining you live from Zurich, wishing you all a very warm welcome, whether you're joining on ubs.com or on LinkedIn. It's certainly been a really eventful few weeks. We've had the first presidential debate. We've had an attempted assassination of the former president. We've had perhaps the biggest IT malfunction in history on Friday. And of course, this past weekend, President Biden withdrawing his candidacy from the US election. To help us make sense of what all of this means for investing, I've got a great team here with me today. From New York, we've got Tom McLaughlin, who's been overseeing our US election content and coverage and has certainly been a very busy man the past few weeks. So thanks to Tom for joining us. Also in New York, we've got Nadia Lavelle, who's our senior US equity strategist, paying attention to what's happening in the US markets. And we've got Constantin Boltz here in Zurich, a senior FX strategist who's been watching closely what's been happening in the currency markets. So Tom, why don't we make a start with you? It's been a really historic few weeks in US politics. How do you see the latest developments shaping the race for the presidency?
Well, Kiran, you're right. It's been a remarkable 4 weeks here in the United States with the presidential race. I would say it's unprecedented. The last time we had a sitting president withdraw from seeking another term was more than 50 years ago when Lyndon Johnson decided to withdraw. But he did it right after the New Hampshire primary, far earlier in the process than President Biden's decision. The Vice President Harris, has effectively locked up the nomination already. She has effectively received commitments from more than half the Democratic delegates, as well as raising an extraordinary amount of money for her campaign, more than $100 million in 48 hours. So she's unlocked a great deal of enthusiasm among the Democratic Party faithful. Now, this coming weekend into next week, we do expect an announcement about a virtual roll call vote. It's unclear when the vice president will designate a running mate, but I expect that to come sooner rather than later. Now, what it does is it forces the Republican Party to restructure its campaign messaging. They will continue to focus on border protection, and they will certainly try to paint the vice president as far too progressive for the American electorate. Both Harris and Trump have negative favorability ratios among likely voters, but Harris's numbers are a little better than Biden's. So we expect this to basically make this a more competitive race. Much, again, will depend on the next few weeks. Harris, for her part, will focus on campaign messaging for reproductive rights, tax relief for lower-income households, job gains during the Biden administration, and economic growth. Normally, we would expect September to be a pivotal month for the presidential election. Because of the circumstances, we expect it to be accelerated, so August will be very interesting to see.
So Harris perhaps making the race a bit more competitive. What differences do you see in the approach that Harris might take, assuming she wins, to that which Joe Biden would have taken?
Well, Harris is going to follow Biden's approach to foreign policy by and large. Global engagement with traditional allies will certainly be top of agenda. She will continue to adopt an adversarial posture towards China. That would be true in both cases, whether it's Trump or Harris. She'll focus on onshoring and nearshoring manufacturing jobs. Again, that's a pivotal point in the Biden campaign prior to his withdrawal. But they'll do it all in the context of energy transition. By contrast, Republicans are going to pursue policies based on economic populism, trade protectionism, transactional isolationism, if you want to call it that, all of which means, in the case of the Republicans, broad-based tax relief, tariffs as a tool of foreign policy, and skepticism over traditional multilateral engagement. So there is a fairly stark choice at this point between Donald Trump as the nominee and Vice President Harris as the presumptive nominee of the Democratic Party.
Great. Thanks, Tom. We're obviously talking election here, and I know we'll have lots of questions from all of you watching on the election. Tom will be staying with us for questions at the end. But for those of you looking for more in-depth analysis, please make sure to also tune in later on today to our dedicated US election live stream, which is taking place in just over 2 hours' time. And we're honored to have Justin Muzenich, who'll be with us, very prominent fixed income investor, of course, but also former Deputy Secretary of the Treasury, under President Trump. So if you're watching on UBS.com, take a look at the link on the right of your screen and you'll see some of the details on how you can access that just in a couple of hours' time. Nadia, we'll turn to you now. Elections have certainly been having some impact on equity markets, but we've also had the earnings season starting as well, and we've already seen some interesting moves coming out of that. What's your take on how it's developed so far?
Yes, Karen, absolutely. You know, the election could create some volatility and noise in the background, but we really have to cut through that and focus on the key signals that ultimately drives the outlook for markets. And that's fundamentals. That's earnings. Remember, you know, profits will matter more than the politics. So this quarter in particular is important in that it could be the first time that we've seen earnings growth for the S&P 493 in quite some time. You know, in aggregate, we know that the earnings recession for the S&P 500 ended last year in the third quarter, but that hasn't been the case for the 493. Earnings have been flat to down for the last five quarters, as you can see here in the chart. You know, we think that the earnings brought in and out is really needed to sustain the market performance brought in and out that we've seen over the last few weeks. We did get cooler CPI and Fed cut expectations that might be able to spark that broadening of the rally, but it's truly earnings that will help it burn brightly and last for some time. So we're still in the early innings of the earnings season, but it will pick up this week. We have over 20% of S&P 500 market cap that's reported. I mean, so far, Karen, it's been mostly financials that have reported, and you know, we have a sprinkle of consumer and industrial names. In general, companies are modestly beaten. We're seeing the medium company beaten by about 3 percentage points, so slightly below the historical average. But you know, we've been looking for 10 to 12% EPS growth for the quarter. So things are pacing roughly in line with our expectations. Now, the tone from banks have been fairly constructive. What they're seeing is a pickup in capital markets activity. And they've also noted that the consumer remains fairly resilient with pretty stable spending trends, though the lower end consumer, which we've been hearing for some time, is under continues to be under inflation pressures. You know, credit card delinquency have ticked up, but again, that's part of the normalization process off of a low base, and that should start to peak out with charge-offs this quarter or next. Some of the consumer staple companies, though, have been pointing to a more price-conscious consumer and one that's looking for value. And there's this looming concern and question if some of these companies might have taken too many price increases over the last couple of years, and that could start to impact volume growth going forward as the consumer pushes back. So that's something that we're watching. Within industrials, there's a suggestion that the destocking cycle goal is now behind us, and so the bottom might be in, so we could start to see a pickup in new order growth on the horizon. Now, in terms of tech, Alphabet will report later today. It will be the first of the hyperscalers. You know, I think investors are going to be keenly listening for any updates on CapEx outlook. We have had some positive data points though already in AI from the ex-US companies that have already reported, Karen. You know, Taiwan Semi, ASML last week, and SAP this morning all suggest that demand still remains quite robust. So Karen, so far a decent start to the season, but we still have the heavy hitters ahead of us.
Right, yeah, so decent start, profit over politics. I like that as a slogan for investors. Don't know how well it would play in this political sphere, but I like that as a slogan. What do you say to investors who are asking about valuations? You know, that's a very common question. Like, yeah, we get the story, big tech's great, 10% earnings growth, but didn't it go up a lot already? Is it fully baked in? What are you saying to clients about how to think about valuations?
And that's a fair question. I mean, to some extent, one could argue that a lot of good news is already priced in earnings into the market, just given where valuations are elevated above the longer term average. But, you know, it isn't the case for just only tech and the Mag 7, as you can see in the chart. You know, valuation has somewhat crept up for the rest of the markets, too. We now have a market that in aggregate is trading at 21 times forward PE versus that 10-year average of 18 times. But we are below the levels that we saw during the pandemic. There's somewhat of a bifurcation in the market. And by that, I mean, because the Magnificent Seven, as we talked about earlier, has exited the earnings recession. So that valuation multiple is on higher earnings, while the 493 is still trying to squeeze out some earnings growth and recovering. So that valuation multiple is still somewhat on depressed earnings. It is not unusual, Karen, to see high multiples on cyclically depressed earnings as the market is anticipating a recovery for those, and then the multiple tends to normalize. You know, on the Mag 7, many of these companies are being driven by secular growth trends, particularly AI, which is still in the relatively early innings, and it's been difficult to forecast. And so there's a high probability that the earnings estimates are still too low for some of those names, and that could move up in a step function fashion. So some of these companies in the tech space could see profit margin expansion due to the AI-related profitability gains. So these companies can grow into their valuation multiples. But all that said, it is important to remember that, you know, while valuations are important, you know, historically they tend to be more a gauge of longer term performance and less so a driver of near term performance. But of course, Karen, we want to avoid getting into a trap of a valuation bubble. We don't think that we're in one, but we also don't necessarily want elevated valuation to be a deterrent and potentially miss good investment opportunities. And that is why that earnings trajectory picture that we talked about earlier is quite critical, Karen, because near term, that is what's going to drive this market.
Okay, thanks, Nadia. Having accounted for what's happening with earnings, some of those thoughts on valuations, what are you recommending that investors actually do with their US equity holdings today?
Karen, at the very least, is to stay invested, at least as a benchmark way to the US. And I know sometimes there's a home country bias ex-US. We think that there is further upside to this market. You know, in fact, here we recently lifted our year-end price target for the S&P 500 to 5,900. So that's roughly, you know, 5 to 6% upsides from current levels. Now, volatility could pick up, as we know, as the election approaches. And for those who might be a little bit apprehensive, we would use, you know, derivatives, including structures and option hedging strategy to really navigate that. But stay grounded and use the pullback, you know, should they happen, to really add to those quality stocks. So, you know, we're talking about companies with healthy balance sheet, good free cash flow generation, and solid management teams. You know, as you know, we do tilt towards more the areas of the market that have that secular tailwinds behind them. So that includes exposure to the themes like, you know, healthcare innovation, energy transition, AI. I would say a lot of the AI names have rallied a lot over the last year, but we still think that there's more to go and there's a strong growth runway ahead. You know, it won't be in a straight line. It really ever is, as we know, but there's also in that lies the opportunity. I would say particularly for those who are still trying to build an allocation position to AI. So money is pouring in to like build out the AI infrastructure, which, you know, should be beneficial to the enablers in the space. So by that, we mean semis and, you know, power supply companies. As we go through the earnings season, as I noted earlier, we'll be looking for updates on CapEx from the hyperscalers in particular. You know, the first quarter, we did see a sizable increase in CapEx expectations for 2024 that pushed it up to over $200 billion in aggregate for the top four hyperscalers. I just want to take a moment to put that in perspective, because when you think about that, that is more than the market cap of 90% of the S&P 500 companies. So wow, a lot of money going into this space, and all of that is going to help to drive outsized earnings growth, particularly for semis. You know, so we continue to like the AI story, and you know, we all acknowledge that US is dominant in that story, but it's not just limited to the US. It's semi equipment companies as well. In Europe is part of that as well as those suppliers in Asia and some of the large platform companies. Over the next couple of weeks, over the last few weeks, we have seen, you know, some of the year-to-date laggards really catch a bid on this premise of cooler inflation, pulling forward Fed's rate cut cycle. So the market is now pricing in 2 to 3 rate cuts for this year. We still expect 2 for this year, starting in September, and we think that the economy remains on the path for soft landing, so fairly healthy economic growth. One of the sectors that we would like to play for a catch-up trade is industrials, Karen. This is our cyclical play, but it also has exposure to some of those secular trends that we've been talking about, you know, AI, nearshoring, and energy transition. Karen, I would say to put a pin in it, the core message is to stay invested, build that foundation in secular growth, and be opportunistic to add to some of the year-to-date laggers for that catch-up trade.
Great, thanks, Nadia. And I can only second that notion of building up that secular exposure and that structural exposure into some of these names. I think we see a lot of investors here in Europe perhaps traditionally haven't allocated so much towards the US market, but there's so many exciting opportunities as you've highlighted, in getting that structural exposure to the US up towards benchmark levels is, you know, really an important theme, especially for investors in Europe who perhaps historically have not invested so much in the US. Konstantin, I'm going to turn to you now. I'm going to change gears onto the FX space. This live stream, of course, is called What's Driving Markets, Elections, or Earnings? And perhaps in your space, there's another player in there, which might be interest rates. How have FX markets been reacting to the various macro and political developments we've seen over the past few weeks?
Hi, Kieran. Thanks a lot. To be really honest, markets have not reacted that much to the political developments. We could have seen some Trump trades in other asset classes. So Trump trades in the sense of specific asset classes which gained in value on the rising odds of a second Trump presidency. And if you then look at FX markets, one could argue that the dollar should have been stronger on the back of that because of the tariffs, which could impact the rest of the world more negatively than the US, and therefore a stronger dollar. So on the back of that, if you saw Trump trades in other asset classes, you should have seen a stronger dollar over the last few weeks. And the opposite has happened. So we've seen a weaker dollar over the last few weeks. And why did we see that? Because of weaker macro data, especially out of the US, a weaker CPI report, and therefore a bit of repricing of the US Federal Reserve monetary policy cycle. So that in the end weakened the dollar. So to answer your question, what drove markets, politics, or macro? It was more macro and interest rates. Looking at commodities, gold has actually reached a new all-time high a few weeks ago. And also there, in our view, that was more on the base of US macroeconomics and the US monetary policy. So if we see lower interest rates in the US, that clearly supports the gold price. Apart from that, we have seen strong central bank buying and also strong ETF inflows already throughout the year. And last but not least, there might also be some geopolitical risk premium in the gold price, as it's known as a safe haven. So maybe there we see a little bit of the political angle. But overall, I could say in FX and commodity markets, the elections have only had a mild effect so far. That can still come, but so far. And macro data and the impact on interest rates and monetary policy has been in the driver's seat.
Great, thank you. So how are you recommending that investors position in FX today?
I think one point is very important, and I think Nadia and Tom already touched on that. Politics is only one driver in markets, and there are many other drivers as well. And as we've seen over the last few weeks, monetary policy can be a bigger driver than politics, and the elections are still 3 months away. So we caution to position on specific election outcomes right now, because other factors can actually move markets in the meantime. So it's very dangerous to be outright long or short a specific currency right now just for the US election. On the other hand, volatilities in FX markets are actually very low at the moment. So we advise investors who are exposed to larger FX swings or could be exposed to larger FX swings and don't want to feel them to actually hedge right now, because hedging costs are low at the moment. And the closer we get to the US elections, we would expect hedging costs to increase. So if you want to hedge, do it now. Concerning gold, we still recommend to hold gold as a diversifier, as a safe haven in the portfolio. We do see, as I said before, a lot of drivers right now. Monetary policy is being supportive, central bank buying is being supportive, and we see the safe haven aspect in the geopolitical risk around the US election. So we like gold. We see gold going higher on the back of lower interest rates, and therefore recommend to hold an allocation to gold in the portfolios, just like we do in our mandates.
Great. Thank you, Konstantin. It's now our favorite time, which is when we get to take all of the questions from you. And thanks so much for sending those in and engaging. I'm just going to take a look at some of those and just pick some out. So yeah, Tom, so why don't we start on with you? We talked a bit about the differences between Harris and Biden. But what do you see as some of the principal differences between Trump and Harris, which of course the two candidates now, most likely with regard to bilateral relations with China and also with respect to foreign policy?
Sure thing. Well, for 70 years or thereabouts, the United States has pursued a policy of strategic ambiguity vis-a-vis Taiwan. What is striking to me over the course of the last month has been former President Trump's willingness to go ahead and speak about his hesitation to pursue the same degree of strategic ambiguity as has been the case in the United States foreign policy for generations. So there's that. I think Harris is a much more full-throated support for Taiwan and for the defense of Taiwan. So that's one basic difference. Taking a step back and perhaps from a 30,000-foot perspective, the fundamental difference is that former President Trump is an adherent to bilateral relations over traditional alliances or multilateral engagement. So when I talked about transactional isolationism, his policy will not be that different from the first term, where he will basically engage with other countries on a one-on-one basis, rather than pursuing it through multilateral organizations. That's just his nature. He also is a proponent of tariffs, and that is that's as close as you got to get to a guarantee if he is elected that there will be additional tariffs imposed, although the scope and the style may be subject to debate. In the case of Harris, she will follow Biden's lead, I think, in this regard. She is a supporter of multilateral organizations and traditional alliances. In both cases, however, taking a step back and returning to the bilateral relationship between the United States and China, both campaigns and both administrations, no matter which one is elected, would pursue a more adversarial posture. Not antagonistic necessarily, but adversarial. In other words, we'll be in a position where there's intense competition between the two nations, and there will be points of friction that will occur regardless of who is elected.
Great, thanks, Tom. I can see lots of election ones coming in, but I'm going to pick one that's not election related for you, Nadia. So small caps have been doing quite well over the past few days. Do you expect that to continue?
Wow, yes. Small cap, you know, has seen a significant outperformance the last couple of weeks. I mean, officially, we are neutral on small caps and think that the risks are somewhat balanced. We've seen small cap rally up about 10% in the last 2 weeks, significantly outperforming their large cap peers. And the trade, I would say, Karen, that rotation has been more macro and technical driven rather than fundamentals. I mean, some short squeeze as well, and we've seen some neutralizing of positions. And this is all on the hopes that the Fed would kick off its rate cutting cycle in September, and that would provide some relief to small caps balance sheet. As we know, small caps tend to have more exposure to floating rate debt, as well as the potential for a rate cut stimulating the economy, and smaller companies tend to be more economically sensitive. Now, while all of that sounds great and plausible in theory, the proof at the end of the day is going to be in the pudding, and that pudding is going to be earnings. Reality is, what we've seen so far this year is that small caps have had significant downward earnings revisions, while their large cap peers, as we talked about earlier, earnings have been moving higher, upward revisions. So we'll learn more as we go through this earnings season on if small cap can start to see a more sustainable inflection up in earnings. We would be careful about aggressively chasing the recent performance, as it just remains to be seen if small caps will have follow through on the support. But it doesn't mean that not having exposure to small cap. At the end of the day, we're neutral, so you should have a benchmark weighted exposure to small cap, but be careful on chasing it too much at these levels, particularly after such a strong rally.
Thanks, Nadia. Very wise advice. Thank you. One more back on the election for Konstantin, I think. So the dollar performed well in Trump's first term. Do you think the second term would be different? And then more generally, what do you think are the most obvious trades in FX around the US election?
Yeah, it's a difficult one. I mean, on the one hand, you could argue that we know how Trump acts, and therefore he will do the same as he did in his first term. And that should potentially, with tariffs, be a dollar positive. On the other hand, I think there are a number of factors which make it difficult for Trump to have such a positive impact this time compared to last time. First of all, the debt to GDP is much higher than it was in 2017 when he took office. And in 2017, the interest rates were around 1.5%. They are now above 4%. So, or to put it differently, the US paid about $500 billion on debt payments in 2017-18, and now almost $1 trillion a year. So I think the financial leeway for him is much more restricted compared to last time. A second one is the surprise factor of Donald Trump is definitely not there anymore compared to last time. I think the rest of the world in Brussels and Beijing, they know how he will act, and they are probably preparing for it right now. So the question is, can he have as much impact as he did last time? And then just looking at the dollar is about 10, even a bit more than 10% stronger on a trade-weighted basis compared to last time. So the dollar is actually trading rather rich at the moment. So all of that probably makes it a bit more difficult for the dollar to gain much further on a Trump presidency compared maybe to last time. You asked on a few specific Trump trades. I think the most obvious one will be the Chinese renminbi. Trump proposed tariffs of 10% for the rest of the world, but 60 to 100% on Chinese goods. So I guess China will be his main focus. And apart from that, I think the border between the US and Mexico is probably also one of his priorities. So the Mexican peso stands out there as one currency which could be hurt. But apart from that, we will only figure out once he comes into office, if he does, what his priorities are. But I think those are the two most obvious ones.
Brilliant. Thank you, Konstantin. I can see that we're running low on time. So I'd just like to close there and say thank you to you, Konstantin, Nadia, and Tom for joining us. And thank you all for tuning in on UBS.com. So thank you all for joining, and see you all soon, and have a good day.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.